This is Charlotte Tux. I'm Mike Collins. It's taken a long time to be able to say this, but most people agree the U.S. economy is now about as good as it gets. 2017 ended with the stock market in record territory. The jobless rate had fallen to a 17-year low. And one of our guests this hour, Mark Vittner, senior economist at Wells Fargo, says we're finally putting the financial crisis behind us. But what lies ahead? Will the economy continue to improve? Will your investments gain in value? Will the new tax plan really spread the wealth? We get some educated opinions this hour, and we welcome back the aforementioned Mark Vittner. He is in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
And joining us by phone is Michelle Meyer, senior U.S. economist with Bank of America Merrill Lynch out of New York, and she's joining us from her home because of the, was it Snowmageddon, the snow bomb? What is it? What are they calling it up there?
Calling it a snow bomb.
Snow bomb.
Yeah, it's pretty unpleasant.
Yes. Well, stay warm. It was Goldman Sachs that declared the economy is about as good as it can get. Is that because of low unemployment, low inflation, low interest rates, the soaring stock market, the fact that we haven't had many bumps in the road along the way for quite a while? Is it all those factors? Is it any one that you can point to? And Mark, I'll start with you.
I think it's all of the above and also the absence of inflation. And there doesn't seem to be any obvious excess in the economy that would bring about trouble. And so I think that's where they get the sense that it's as good as it gets. I do think that Goldman's view of the world is clouded somewhat by the big city performance. Big cities are doing far, far better than mid-sized towns and rural areas.
Has that changed at all in the last year?
It's probably improved a little bit over the last year.
Why?
But mainly because it's getting so costly to do business in some of the large towns that folks are looking at smaller cities as an alternative. But there's an awful lot of areas. If you go to Memphis or you go to St. Louis, you do not see all that much evidence that things are anywhere near as good as they've ever been.
Maybe it's because I'm risk averse. Maybe it's because I'm just a natural skeptic, Michelle. But when things are this good for so long for so many people, I begin to worry that the bottom is going to fall out. Is this based on good sound fundamentals, or is there exuberance there that might be filtered out and cause some change in the future?
Yeah, I think we have to put that statement as good as it's going to get into perspective. So it is true that 2017 was a strong year for economic growth, not just here in the U.S., but also globally. We had a synchronized global recovery. The stock market performed clearly very well. We had very little volatility or big shocks in the markets. So it was a good year, but it's also in perspective relative to what we've seen the prior several years, where we've had a recovery that's been quite slow. So this has been what I've called the fits and starts recovery. Since 2009, we've had these periods of slight spurts of growth followed by cycles where the economy suffered a bit. There was a confidence shock. There were, other more structural challenges that the economy had to adapt to. So, yes, last year was good, and I think we're going to see continued expansion this year, but I'm not sure that we can say that 2007 was as good as it's going to get. I actually think as we look ahead to 2018, there's more capacity for growth. By our estimates for the U.S. economy, we're not yet at full capacity. We haven't yet what we call closed the output gap, so there's still room to expand. The unemployment rate is hovering close to low levels, but there's no reason that it can't fall further, especially in this environment where we now have a bit of a spurt of growth from fiscal stimulus.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about the growth, the potential for growth in 2018 here in a few minutes, but let's go back to the recovery, because Mark, you've said that most recoveries out of recessions move quickly and then they slow down, and this has been the exact opposite. It was slow going all the way, and in the last several months, things have begun to pick up. In the last 9 months, we've seen what you call a vigorous stretch of growth. Do you understand why?
Well, I know why growth picked up in the last year. Business fixed investment picked up in a very meaningful way, and that's something that does happen.
Do we know why?
I think we have a couple of ideas. I mean, one is that with the labor market tightening up, folks are beginning to substitute. Businesses are substituting capital for labor, so physical capital for labor. So because it's getting harder to find the workers, they're having to automate more processes. Also, we saw a rollback in regulations last year and a slowdown in new regulations, and I think that improved the environment for small businesses. The other thing that
does it in fact improve the environment for small businesses, or does it just make them feel better about themselves and therefore more able to move forward on things that they could have done anyway, but they didn't do it?
Well, the issue for small businesses is they're small, and so the owner, the CEO, the mm-hmm. top salesperson, and the chief compliance officer are all the same folks, right. same person. And if they're spending more time attending meetings trying to figure out how to comply with the new regulations, then they have less time to grow their businesses. And so I really think that was meaningful, and that and you look at our survey, you look at the small business, the NFIB survey, and you see the proportion of small business owners that say that regulation was their most pressing problem has fallen faster than really any time since the 1980s.
And there was one more thing you wanted to talk about. I interrupted.
Well, I said the other thing that has improved is the housing outlook, and that was late this year, that single-family home building. Mm-hmm. And it's somewhat surprising, and you have to be cautious because housing activity normally falls off when you get into fall and winter. We had the hurricanes. It disrupted activity a little bit. But it does look like that single-family home building, particularly for entry-level buyers, has picked up in a way that's likely to provide a meaningful boost to the economy in 2018.
And Michelle, given the from a 30,000-foot distance, the incredible destruction we've witnessed from these storms and the fires in California that have taken out so many homes, are we going to see I don't want to say artificial, but an additional rise in home building because the industries that supply home building and repair because they have all these homes to rebuild and repair.
Absolutely. I think you do get a somewhat short-term boost to activity in the housing market, both in terms of new home sales and single-family housing starts. And we're already seeing that, as Mark alluded to, the October and November data were very strong, particularly November, where home sales reached cycle highs and single-family starts edged higher. So I think that those dynamics are already starting to play out. What I worry about, though, is that we're simply pulling forward activity from the future. So if we get this big burst of growth as you have the repair and rebuilding efforts over the next few months, and then we end up settling on a slower trajectory early next year. And there's also lots of seasonality issues when it comes to the monthly housing data, particularly right around the turn of the year in the winter. So the last two winters were unseasonably warm, and the data looked very strong in the winter months. Now we're having, at least for the past few weeks, unseasonably cold weather across the East Coast, and that could potentially create some negative headwinds for housing. So I think we have to be a little bit careful in terms of looking into these monthly housing statistics, given how many moving parts there are in terms of understanding the trend versus these short-term fluctuations.
And a few minutes ago, Michelle mentioned, Mark, that she felt that the economy in 2018 was going to do even better, and I think you agree with her. You see growth shifting into high gear in 2018?
Into a higher gear. The last two quarters have been better than 3%, and I don't know that we can grow 3% quarter after quarter, but 2.7, 2.8% growth next year looks likely, mainly because of that strength that we're seeing in capital goods orders.
Prior to the Great Recession, what will we be growing at quarter by quarter?
Yeah, well, prior to the Great Recession, we were at about 3% growth.
Okay.
I remember listening to folks say it's impossible for the economy to go from 3% to a recession in 6 months, and I think we did it in 5. So it was
they were right.
Well, I don't know how we've revised those data. The GDP data get revised and revised forever, so I don't know how they look right now.
And you said that the nation's manufacturing recovery has been driven by oil production, technology advances, and pent-up consumer demand for vehicles. The price of gasoline is going up again. I heard that on the news yesterday, but also read yesterday that the auto sector is set to cool, that auto sales are expected to be lower this year than they were last. Do you agree with that, and if so, why?
It's certainly possible. Auto sales got a big boost following the hurricanes because we had all those cars destroyed in Houston, and so that gave us a little bit of a boost. The used car market had been weaker, and the hurricanes gave that a bit of a reprieve. We were going through a little bit of a mini cycle. The autos picked up much earlier in the cycle. It was almost like it was the one part of the business cycle that was fairly normal, because there was a lot of political pressure applied to the auto sector, and it revived pretty much along normal lines in this recovery.
If oil production is up, and I assume that's what you mean by oil production being a factor in the nation's manufacturing recovery, if oil production is up, why are oil prices, why are gasoline prices up?
Well, the oil production's up because prices have come up, and that's brought more. Okay. That's made it profitable for more wells to be restarted. And about one third of our growth early on in the recovery came from the energy boom, and about another third came from the tech sector. And so, if you were in an energy or a tech market, you did very well. So, Houston and San Francisco from 2010 to 2014. Were the fastest growing metro areas in the country by a long shot, and they accounted for a disproportionate share of the economy's growth. Energy cooled because we went through that down cycle when prices collapsed, and it took manufacturing down with it. And at the same time, one of the reasons that oil prices came down was the global economy slowed, which also took manufacturing down. And so we've seen both of those trends reverse. And so the improvement in the global economy has helped shore up energy prices, right, which has helped shore up. So the improvement in the global economy helped shore up manufacturing. The improvement in energy prices have also given manufacturing a little bit of a boost.
Michelle, I know that the stock market is not the economy, but it seems to be one of the two is mirroring the other. The economy is chugging along pretty well. The stock market is absolutely chugging along pretty well. Is it following the economy, or is the economy following the market?
Well, you're right. In the long term, obviously, they're supposed to trend together in the sense that when economic growth is strong, it means earnings potential is stronger. Overall consumer demand tends to be stronger, and stocks should perform well in that environment. But throughout this cycle, we've seen some divergences. And part of that is because of the fact that the corporate profits recovery ran in excess of the recovery in the broader economy. So in the early stages of the recovery, you had very strong profits growth. But overall economic growth was quite subpar, running just slightly above what we would consider trend to be. And that presumably helped to spur stronger stock market returns relative to what we saw from overall economic growth. We're now at a point where we could be potentially starting to shift things around. Now, obviously, tax reform, which presumably we'll talk about later, is a additional wild card. But all else equal, what we've been starting to see very slow evidence of is a shift from income in the corporate sector very slowly shifting into labor. And that means that could help to generate stronger economic growth. But potentially those wage gains could weigh a bit on profitability. So I think you have to think about the dynamics. What are driving the increases in the stock market versus what's driving the increases in the overall economic recovery at any given point? Long term, yes, they trend together. Short term, you could have differences based off of where the income is flowing in the economy.
So we only have 30 seconds here, but so what I'm hearing you say is that if wages go up, corporate profitability goes down, and therefore the stocks may suffer. And if wages go up, there is the specter of inflation. Would that also be true?
Yeah, I think it's all about the degree, the magnitude. Some modest increase in wages, modest increase in inflation, that all makes sense, and that's a good sign for the economic recovery, and stocks should be fine in that environment. Wages are going up. They're able to pass some of that on to the consumer through higher inflation. But if you have outsized upward shocks...
Let me stop you there. We have to stop. Michelle Meyer with Bank of America. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And Trinity Episcopal School presenting Freedom Fete 2018, Raising, Educating, and Nurturing Boys and Girls, a discussion about the differences between male and female brains. January 25th, 6 p.m. at Trinity. Tomorrow is the first Friday of the new year, therefore the first weekly news roundup. And weather leads the new year with the New Year's news with frigid single-digit temperatures and snow in unlikely places. The cold has also hit the city's homeless population hard. There have been multiple power outages as well. The Panthers, of course, suffering a disappointing loss in the playoffs against New Orleans this Sunday with a tough game ahead. We'll talk about many of those things and more tomorrow at 9.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Coming up on the next On Point, frostbitten Florida, snowy South Carolina, sub-zero New England. We'll look at the big freeze and Mother Nature's message. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Bundle up and stay tuned for On Point from 10 till noon following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, a 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's Banking Town. We're talking about the economy here with Mark Vittner, senior economist at Wells Fargo, and Michelle Meyer, senior U.S. economist for Bank of America Merrill Lynch. What does the year ahead hold, given the performance of 2017, which was pretty good by all economic indicators? We talked a second ago, Michelle, about the stock market, and it's been rising almost nonstop since the recession. In 2017, the Dow gained – those of you with 401ks can compare your performance against this. The Dow gained 25.1%. My portfolio didn't. The S&P climbed 19.4%, and the NASDAQ is up 28.2%. And yesterday, I believe, or the day before yesterday, the NASDAQ set a record high. Should that concern investors or people with their retirement savings in 401ks? Are these gains based on sound fundamentals, or are this constant rise to these record levels is a correction imminent, inevitable? Michelle.
Yeah, sure. So obviously that's a key concern when you're looking at the continued increase in asset prices, and the stock market is one of those assets that are appreciating. The view of our equity analysts at Bank of America is that there's still room to run. They're not yet seeing signs of exuberance in the market. That would be concerning. They think, yes, valuations are elevated, but in an environment where rates are still quite low, and even if they edge higher, they're unlikely to see a dramatic move up, you still could have support for the stock market. So our analysts are still pretty positive about the prospects for the stock market to continue to appreciate in 2018.
Maybe I misunderstood this. I thought that CNBC had reported that Bank of America Merrill Lynch sees the end of the bull market this year. Is that true?
That is no. Our equity analyst, Savita Subramanian, who is the head of U.S. equity strategy, has continued growth throughout the year.
Okay.
Now, there's risk scenarios that she talks about and the other analysts talk about, so perhaps it was one of the risk scenarios.
Okay. Are you on the same page over down the street at Wells Fargo?
Yes. We're not. I think that when you look at asset prices in general, for the most part, we are either fully priced or maybe somewhat aggressively priced, but I don't think we're speculatively priced. And you look at past bubble periods, and that's where the curve almost goes parabolic, and we haven't really seen that. And if you look at the outlook for earnings, it's still very positive. And tax reform, I think, is probably being underestimated as to what it's going to do for corporate America in 2018.
And will that trickle down?
Well, I'm not one to use the phrase trickle down. I am not. I don't think that's the way the world works. And I think back to all the economics that I took, and I took an awful lot of economics classes, and we never once discussed trickle down theory. That was never once one of the things that came up. And typically what people call trickle-down economics is actually Keynesian economics is what they're referring to. And so it's always kind of boggled my mind.
So are you saying it doesn't work? That the stories we're told that when you give big corporations tax breaks, that the average guy on the street eventually will feel the positive effects of that? Are you saying it doesn't work, or are you saying something else?
No, I'm saying that when capital is freed to find its highest risk-adjusted rate of return, and that's mm-hmm. true for financial capital or human capital, mm-hmm. the economy will perform better. And I think that tax reform has addressed that. I mean, certainly not perfectly, but I think it has done that in a way that will be meaningful for the economy. The announcements that we've seen by businesses, and a lot of people are wondering, is it PR? But a lot of the businesses that have announced these bonus payments, they, for the most part, earn most of their income in the United States, and so they benefit a great deal from the reduction. They were paying taxes at very close to the top marginal tax rate. And so they were some of the biggest beneficiaries. And so it makes sense that they're the ones that have made these announcements. But I do think that just from the number of inquiries that we've received, there is going to be a significant repatriation of capital coming back into the U.S.
And what will that mean?
I think that we will see buybacks. We will see
stock buybacks
and dividends. But that makes sense because a lot of the companies that have a lot of capital overseas do not have a lot of capital needs in the U.S. They don't have large factories. I mean, Facebook, for example, they employ a relative handful of people. Yet I believe Tyler Cowen said that 20% of all the pictures that have ever been taken in the history of mankind were taken and shared on Facebook in the last year. And so in Eastman Kodak had 270,000 employees at their peak. Facebook's got about 10. There's just not the need. Facebook doesn't have the need to build big factories.
Right. So, Michelle, if the tax plan does and there's all indications that it will end up in companies buying back stock, paying dividends out to shareholders and maybe raising the compensation level of their senior staff. What does it mean when a company buys back stock? Doesn't that mean ultimately they don't have as many dividends to pay out? They're even wealthier than they were before. And if they become wealthier than they were before, does that ever result in higher wages?
That is the key question at the very end. And that's how this tax plan would have the potential to multiply through the economy, is if you are seeing corporations have more wealth, lower tax rates, higher asset price, higher prices, stock values, and valuation, do they then use that additional cash to pass it on to their employees? So to me, I think in this environment where the labor market is very tight, there is potential that you will see some sharing of that windfall. So the unemployment rate, 4.1%, we'll see what it comes out tomorrow. We think it's only heading lower over this year and next. So if companies do want to expand, they need to invest in labor. And when labor markets are tight, to get that labor, there is a risk they have to pay more, which means higher wage growth across the board. It doesn't happen immediately. I don't think we're going to see instantaneously companies say we're richer, which means we're going to pay our employees more right away. But it could happen through the natural economic channels, which is through the tightness in the labor market and the desire to expand of these companies, which means hiring workers at a higher price point.
This was a $1.5 trillion tax cut, and that certainly benefits corporations, and it seems to favor high-wage earners, but the middle class, at least initially, may see some extra cash in their pockets as well. Some of those things sunset after, I think, 10 years. Is the hope that middle-class taxpayers who do get something back, I'm not sure how much they get, will spend that money or save that money?
I think it's going to be a bit of both. So when you think about the individual tax cuts, you're right, they are temporary. So they actually sunset in 2025. So for an individual, they're looking at their tax cuts, and they should be operating on the assumption that these are temporary tax adjustments, and after 2025, their tax rates could reset back up. So that temporary nature of the tax cuts means that the tendency to spend out of it may be reduced relative to a permanent tax reduction. If you look at the 2001 Bush tax cuts, the 2008 rebate, most of the literature suggests that consumers spend anywhere from 25% to about a third of the tax windfall. The rest is used for paying down debt, a pretty substantial amount, particularly amongst that middle income group, and the remainder is used for savings. So it's a large dollar amount that is being adjusted in terms of disposable income from tax cuts. Some of that will certainly go into the economy through stronger consumer spending, but a decent amount will also move into savings and reduction of debt.
Let me say something heretical here. When the economy is going as well as it's going, if it's the best it can possibly be, and it's going to get better in 2018, if the stock market is soaring through the stratosphere and setting records, whether they're legitimate or not, if unemployment is low and getting lower, why do we need a tax cut? And doesn't the tax cut run the risk of artificially, at least initially, heating up the economy, resulting in inflation, which reverses the gains of the tax cut?
Well, that is a whole nother debate, which is a very fair question to raise. My view, the reality is that we probably didn't need stimulus at this point in the cycle for the precise reasons that you said, which is that we have an economy that's been running at a pretty decent clip. The unemployment rate is low, the stock market is high, and putting stimulus in place at this point in the cycle would risk overheating the economy and pulling forward growth from the future in a way that could potentially be damaging. I think what the intention was initially when these discussions happened in Washington was for real tax reform, deficit-neutral tax reform that simplified the tax system, improved the tax system, and helped to create a better working environment going forward. The end result was not quite that. as you noted, it's deficit expansion, which means that it's outright stimulus at a later stage in the business cycle. So this is an experiment. We'll see what it ends up doing, and we're not going to know the long-term consequences for some time.
You want to chime in on this, Mark?
Well, there's more reform on the corporate side, and that's where our taxes were out of line with our competitors around the world. And in order to get corporate tax reform through, you had to reform individual tax rates as well. And there wasn't as much reform done at the individual level as there was at the corporate level, but I do believe that the corporate tax reform is going to help promote growth over the near term and the long term.
And I know neither of you are lawyers or politicians; you're economists. But the corporate tax cuts have been labeled as permanent, while the individual tax cuts are sunsetted. They have sunsetting clauses. Is anything really permanent? Couldn't the next administration or the next Congress come in and say, oh, no, it's not, and change everything?
Well, that's certainly possible, and that's also true on the sunset. I mean, those lower individual tax rates could be extended.
So why make the distinction? Why say the corporate cuts, which I would think would be unpopular to the very people who supported Donald Trump, why say they're permanent, but your individual rates, well, they're going to go away?
Well, that has to do with the budget rules and the way that they score it. And it's the same thing when you look at this, that it's going to blow a hole in the deficit. Almost half of the increase in the deficit over the next 10 years comes from the treatment of how we interpret the repatriation of corporate profits. There's about $3 trillion of profits stranded overseas right now that folks don't want to bring back and pay taxes at 35%.
Right.
You know, if they come back and if we bring it back and it all comes back and it's taxed at 15%, that actually adds $450 billion to the U.S. Treasury. But the budget rules will show that as a $700 billion loss in revenues because it wasn't taxed at 35%.
Okay. All right. Accountants, they're the bane of our existence. Workers, we are told, average rank-and-file workers should see lower taxes in their February paychecks. On average, how much more do we know? And how much of a tax cut for average consumers would there need to be for us to notice a bounce in the economy?
Well, I can't tell you in terms of a percentage basis, but as to how it breaks out. But most folks who work and receive a regular paycheck are going to see an increase in their take-home pay.
What, $50, $90, $150?
It depends on how $10. Much money they earn and how much. But it will be a noticeable increase, and it will be larger than what we saw in the Bush tax
even cuts. Even though at the beginning of the year you pay more taxes because withholding is higher on FICA and Social Security and Medicare, et cetera, it's higher at the beginning of
well,
the year.
Well, it may be because of insurance cost.
Right.
So
you'll even see it in February.
You'll definitely see it in February because if you have your withholding, if it only goes up in January, then it'll look even larger when it comes. It'll look even more significant when it comes up in February. But it will be noticeable. When the Bush tax cuts, which were very temporary and were very targeted, they were largely offset by a spike in gasoline prices and food prices that occurred right there. And that's one of the reasons that they did not provide much of a lift.
You predict 0.3 percentage point economic growth as the result of the corporate tax cuts, 0.3%. Is that a lot?
That's a lot in an economy that's been growing about 2% a year. So that's more than 10% additional growth.
Is there a way to measure the impact on the economy on individual tax cuts in the same way?
Well, that's all of the tax cuts. I think that the corporate tax cuts are more meaningful for the economy in the very near term.
Some have expressed concerns about what this tax cut may do to the federal deficit. Apparently, Mark, you're not concerned. Why?
Well, I'm not concerned because I think the CBO scoring was off. I'm also not concerned because the deficit is huge and it's likely to remain huge with this tax law or without it. And I believe that while this is not well timed and it's coming late in the business cycle, that with this tax plan in place, the recovery from the next recession is likely to be stronger than it would have been otherwise. And the last three economic recoveries have been very elongated, have been very slow to get started.
Does the administration know that? Did they the people who put this tax plan together, was that one of their considerations, or is this an afterthought that the economists have noticed about
Mick Mulvaney, who's the head of OMB, was in town last week, and I had just a minute or two with him, and I raised that with him, and he seemed to think that was. He didn't tell me whether or not that was one of the things that they thought about, but he.
And aside from being a former congressman from South Carolina, what's his background?
Well, he's owned a number of different businesses, and I believe he's an attorney by background. I don't know all of his. I just know from the intro into his presentation.
So, Michelle, it's been said that, and we've already talked about this a little bit, that corporations are going to use most of this tax relief to pay dividends to shareholders and buy back their stock and pay their top management more money. How will buying back stock impact the actual stock market?
Well, I think, in general, the way our equity analysts are seeing tax reform is that it is a net positive for the stock market. So they've revised up EPS estimates. And if economic growth does perform better, as we anticipate similar to Mark's estimates, then that further adds support to the stock market. So on balance, the tax reform bills should be, certainly for this year, a support for asset prices.
But so why, if Microsoft is going to buy back or Apple is going to buy back big chunks of their stock, does that not depress the price of the stock? Or does it increase the price of the stock initially at least? It pushes it up?
It increases the price of the stock.
Don't let them buy back anything. Hold on to it.
But think about this. Think about the stock buybacks in the same way that QE worked.
All right.
When the Fed expanded their balance sheet, they bought treasuries. When they bought those treasuries from Goldman Sachs or Bank of America or Wells Fargo, then they had to buy something else. And that's the way that buybacks will feed into the rest of the economy.
So we're going to come back and we're going to talk about consumer spending and we're going to talk about inflation and how this may impact the year ahead economically with Michelle Meyer from Bank of America Merrill Lynch and Mark Bittner from Wells Fargo at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Regional Partnership, which markets the 16-county, two-state region known as Charlotte, USA, to companies looking to expand or relocate in our market. Information about supporting the effort at charlotteusa.com. And Treetops by Lennar, a private, gated, active adult community offering resort-style amenities and Lennar's Everything's Included homes. Details at lennar.com/treetops. treetops. While Charlotte is in the grip of a cold spell, other parts of the Carolinas are under a blanket of snow. Charleston's 5 inches of snow came within an inch of a nearly 30-year-old record. It's part of a winter storm along the eastern seaboard that goes all the way to Maine. And guest host Jane Clayston will have the latest on the deep freeze conditions coming up during On Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will continue our conversation about economic prospects in the year ahead when we come back. Stay with us.
Friends, family, gatherings, you know, there are a million reasons why you might not be caught up on the latest news today. And that's really okay, I promise you. We work around the clock to compile and distill the most important stories from the U.S. and from around the world so that you can be informed at any time. So when you want to check in or when you need to be informed, we're right here. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
From 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're looking at the year ahead economically. Last year was a terrific one for many people, not all. And we're going to try to figure out if maybe more people can enjoy what's been going on in the last year. Michelle Myers joining us. She's a senior U.S. economist for Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Mark Vitner is here, senior economist for Wells Fargo. Prior to the recession, consumers played a major role in the health of the economy. Is consumer spending helping to drive this economy? Michelle.
Consumer spending has been an area of relative strength. So if you look at the pace of consumer spending relative to the pace of GDP growth, consumer spending has been running above for the past few years. So yes, I think consumer spending has been an important driver, and the fundamentals are favorable for the consumer. We've talked a lot about the appreciation of asset prices, the stock market performing well, home prices appreciation. That's all created strong gains in household wealth. And even in an environment where the wealth effect is probably muted, there's just the magnitude of wealth created has presumably helped to underpin consumer spending.
But but the money tied up in your house or the boat mm-hmm. that you bought last year because things looked good, that's not spendable money. You have to sell those assets to spend them, and sometimes that takes time or and is difficult to do. So how much longer can this economy continue to grow without wage increases before we start having people putting more money back on their credit card, which was one of the problems prior to the recession?
Sure. So the way the wealth effect works is you don't actually have to extract the equity from the asset explicitly. That was happening to a certain extent with housing, with cash out refinancing and home equity lines of credit. But the standard theory behind a wealth effect is that because you've accumulated this wealth and you presume it will continue into the future, you're more willing to draw down your savings today and spend more of your disposable income today rather than have to worry about adding to your savings. And we've seen exactly that. The last 2 years, the savings rate has been on a downward trajectory, which means that consumers have become more willing to spend on the view that they have these wealth gains to rely on. But you're right, that's just one part of it. And the main driver for consumer spending is going to be income trajectory, which is going to be a function of compensation or wage growth. And thus far, wage growth has been fairly slow to accelerate. We're still running at about a mid 2% pace year over year on a nominal basis for aggregate wages. We do think the trend should be higher as the unemployment rate continues to fall, but there are potentially some constraints on how high we can get for wage growth in this cycle relative to prior cycles. Some of those constraints are the fact that we've been dealing with low productivity growth that limits how high wages might turn up, compositional shifts in the labor force by demographic group or the type of worker, or other factors that potentially are capping wage growth. But we do think that we will see some upward movement in wages, which should help to underpin consumer spending.
Well, I want to come back to that. Mark, you want to chime in on that?
Well, there's one other way that we can get stronger consumer spending, and that is bringing more people back into the workforce.
Yeah.
And we are seeing that. And that's an important part in our outlook, is that we think that not only is growth going to be stronger next year, but it's going to broaden. And a great example is Amazon's search for a second headquarters. Mm-hmm. The reason Amazon's looking to expand away from Seattle is that they've grown so rapidly there. Then they've leased up a lot of office space. They've pulled a lot of workers from other companies, and they're now competing with themselves for workers and office space.
Yeah.
So they're looking to grow somewhere else. other companies are doing the same thing. And as they expand to other areas, in those areas, in Seattle and Austin and Raleigh, wages have accelerated. They're growing 4% or better a year.
What about here?
Here in Charlotte, they're somewhere in the middle. I mean, we're doing better than the nation. We're up about 3.5% year to year, whereas nationally we're under 3%. The unemployment rate here has tightened up quite a bit, but Charlotte extends a great deal out into some areas. The further you get away from the city, mm-hmm. The more slack you have in the labor market.
Let's talk just a second here about inflation. Sarah emails, how can anyone say, and I guess we've said this earlier in the program, that there is an absence of inflation when both food costs and housing costs are climbing faster than anyone can remember? I am in constant sticker shock, she says. This, quote, great economy, unquote, is not helping me nor many others at all, and I work hard, she says. And you believe, Michelle, that inflation will be the big story in 2018.
Yeah, and Sarah's absolutely right that you have to think about which components of price inflation. So when we talk about inflation, oftentimes we focus on the underlying trend in inflation, which is going to be core inflation, which takes out food and energy prices. So it's the part of inflation that in theory should be most closely tied to the labor market and to wage growth.
Why do we do it that way?
In part because that's the part of inflation that tends to be the stickiest. So you can capture an underlying trend based off of that inflation. It's what the Fed focuses on for the short term as well. And if you're focusing on headline inflation, then you're sensitive to exogenous shocks. You're sensitive to oil price swings. You're sensitive to droughts or weather events that could potentially impact food prices that are temporary adjustments. So by focusing on core, you're getting past some of the noise in the figures, and you're more able to forecast the longer-term trajectory.
So if you believe that inflation will be the big story in 2018, what I'm hearing you say is that we're going to have inflation. So what forces will be driving that inflation?
So I think inflation will be the big story, not because we're going to have dramatic inflation. It's going to be the big story simply because we're not going to have disinflation. And that is a critical distinction. 2017, inflation was the big story because it decelerated. We actually had inflation fall by about five-tenths on the core basis.
But isn't that good?
Well, it's not good in an environment where the labor market is tightening. So it contradicts what you would anticipate from economic models, which is when the labor market is tightening, the unemployment rate is falling, wages should be picking up, and prices should be rising modestly, but they should be rising. That shows that companies have pricing power. Consumers have the ability to absorb that pricing power because they're also seeing wage growth. That's a healthy dynamic. We did not have that last year. And I think the change for this year is that we're going to start to see that play out. And that, to me, is going to be the big story, that the natural mechanism that should work through the economy with a tightness in the labor market, some modest pickup in wages, some modest pickup in inflation will show through. So we're going to be transitioning from disinflation to reflation, even if it is only modest.
Well, and we see inflation picking up this year modestly. But the question really was dealing with housing cost, I think.
Right.
I think and when you look at this economy has been bifurcated in that we've had some pockets of extreme strength, and the cities, larger cities, have done very well. So housing costs in Charlotte have shot up tremendously. Most of the new apartments that have been added have been high-end units, in some cases Class B or C or moderately priced apartments have been torn down and replaced with higher-end apartments. And so the cost of housing has increased dramatically.
Is that a Charlotte phenomenon, or is it happening all over the country?
That's happening, I wouldn't say all over the country, because about three-quarters of all the apartment building has occurred in just 20 metropolitan areas.
Okay.
So so if you were to go to Winston-Salem or Greensboro, you wouldn't see the same increase in housing costs that you do in Charlotte and Raleigh.
But the housing stock has increased remarkably in Charlotte. I mean, we're talking 10,000 units here, 10,000 units there. why isn't that driving down the price of housing? I mean, there's a plethora, there's a great supply of housing.
Well, it's because they're all very high end. And even
what does
that
mean?
The high
marble countertops?
Well,
I mean, seriously, what is a high end apartment?
A high end apartment means.
What is luxury living?
It's better than I lived.
It's wallboard, a floor, a ceiling, and some lights, yeah. And then a marble countertop. Yeah, let's cut to the chase.
But it's high priced real estate. The construction costs have increased, and there's not that much room to cut rents. So even when rents are discounted, yeah, they are much higher than what existed previously.
I'm going to talk about employment before we run out of time, because we have low unemployment, and you've said, Mark, that the economy would be doing even better if we could find the workers. Is that because we're at or near full employment, or because we can't find workers with the right skills?
It's generally you can't find workers with the right skills. And when you get
why not?
Because the unemployment rate's tightened up. And if you look at where job growth has occurred, it's been at the high end. High-skilled positions have been growing very rapidly. And low-skilled, there hasn't been a lot of growth in the middle. It's very hard for a low-skilled worker to make the jump to a high-skilled position.
Okay.
And so that we don't have the farm team building up there in the middle to fill those high-skilled jobs.
So what kind of jobs do we need? What kind of workers do we need? What kind of skills, I guess, do we need?
Well, in the very near term, it is construction and manufacturing are probably where labor shortages in this area are the greatest, because we've seen a big upsurge in single-family construction. We continue to see a lot of apartments being built.
And you're talking about people who actually hammer the nails, those people.
Well, they probably use a nail gun,
basically
framing houses, roofing, and all of the electrical.
And if we build the wall, are we going to be able to find any of those people? That's a serious question.
Well, it's really not so much the wall, but I mean the focus on immigration and the discouragement of immigration and it has certainly made matters worse because we haven't seen that many folks immigrating into the country, and so that's made matters worse. But boy, that's a big subject there. So.
And Lance on Twitter wants to know, how do you add more people to the workforce when we are effectively at full employment with a 4% unemployment rate?
But if you look at the share of the population that's working, it's about 3.5 percentage points lower than it was before we went into the recession. A lot of people have left the workforce because they didn't think that there were viable job opportunities available to them. And now that the labor market is tightening up, we're seeing more of those folks come back into the workforce. A bigger challenge, though, is that we've seen a lot of people get on disability, and it's tough to qualify for disability, and they probably don't want to give it up to come back into the workforce. And then we've got the opioid crisis, which has really made things tough outside of Charlotte. That's a big factor. You go up to Hickory, Morganton, Lenoir, that area, and that is a big weight on the labor force there.
So some expect unemployment to fall this year to about 3.5%, which David Wessel from the Brookings Institution has called remarkable. Will that, Michelle, lead to a rise in wages, and will it just be in those jobs that are where the jobs are hard to fill, or will we see a general rise in wages because Bob got one, so Sue has to get one too?
So yes, in theory, as the unemployment rate continues to fall further below what we would consider NARU or that full employment level, you should see some wage growth pick up. So if we are able to achieve a 3.5% unemployment rate by the end of the year, which would be the lowest that we've seen since the late 1960s, you've got to think that there's going to be some building wage pressure. Now, it's not going to be felt equally across the economy. The sectors that have the highest degree of tightness, labor shortages, presumably are going to see the fastest wage growth. In areas where there's more abundance of labor supply, it's going to be a little bit more challenging for employees to get that bargaining power. But if the expansion persists and the unemployment rate continues to hover at those low levels or even falls further, then we're talking about more widespread wage growth.
According to one analyst, economic news of late has repeatedly surprised experts by beating their expectations. Is that because experts hedge their bets to err on the side of caution, or because the economy has no reason to slow down, or just is going at such a clip that No one could have imagined it. I'm not sure who to ask that question. Michelle, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, I think one of the things that a lot of market participants track is called a data surprise index. So it looks at high-frequency economic data releases relative to the consensus expectation amongst economists. And the data surprise index had been climbing higher up until the last few weeks. It started to edge down a bit, but it reached very, very high levels for this cycle. And I think that shows the fact that the data have been surprising to the upside. There's been acceleration in growth. And when economists often make their forecasts, they're basing it off of the near-term trend plus some mean reversion. So if you have an outsized increase in a data point in any given month, oftentimes the assumption is that there'll be some normalization of that. And what's interesting is that we haven't quite seen that, particularly in the surveys. The manufacturing surveys, the ISM surveys, have been really quite upbeat, and that's helping to drive this continued data surprise on the upside. You're not seeing it across all indicators, but certainly a handful, particularly on the good side of the economy, have been looking quite robust.
The Federal Reserve, we need to talk about interest rates in the remaining moments of this program. They've begun a series of small interest rate increases after keeping things at historic lows since 2008. I think they raised rates three times last year. I think they're on track to do it again three times this year, maybe more. Will those rising rates offset any heating up of the economy caused by this tax cut?
Well, the idea of the Fed is trying. I had mentioned that the financial crisis is finally behind us. The Fed would like to normalize monetary policy, but it's very hard to go from
zero,
the easiest policy that we've ever seen on the monetary side, to something that's more normal. And last year was the first time that they were able to raise interest rates as much as they wanted to in a given year.
Right.
So they would like to do three more hikes this year. The problem is that the overall inflation rate is so low, and unless inflation gets closer to 2% or maybe even a little above it, they may have a hard time getting even three hikes in this year.
So I have 20 seconds. This coming year, you both think, is going to be a better year than 2017. You don't see any alarming things on the horizon, unless, of course, we go to war with North Korea. That could cause a wrench in the works. But will the average person feel better this year than they did last year? Quickly, Michelle, 5 seconds.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Mark?
Absolutely.
Okay. Michelle Meyer, head U.S. economist with the Bank of America Merrill Lynch. I've been given the wrong title all morning. I apologize, Michelle. And Mark Vittner, senior economist at Wells Fargo. Thank you both for the hour.